He paused in the silent corridor of the Wayne Falkland, at the door of the suite he was to enter. It took him a long moment's effort to lift his hand and knock. It was the suite that had belonged to Francisco D'Anconia. There were coils of cigarette smoke weaving through the air of the drawing room, among the velvet drapes and bare polished tables. With its costly furniture and the absence of all personal belongings, the room had that air of dreary luxury which pertains to transient occupancy, as dismal as the air of a flophouse. Five figures rose in the fog at his entrance: Wesley Mooch, Eugene Lawson, James Taggart, Dr. Floyd Ferris, and a slim, slouching man who looked like a rat-faced tennis player, and was introduced to him as Tinky Holloway. "All right," said Reardon, cutting off the greetings, the smiles, the offers of drinks, and the comments on the national emergency. "What did you want?"
"We're here as your friends, Mr. Reardon," said Tinky Holloway. "Purely as your friends for an informal conversation with a view to closer mutual teamwork." "We're anxious to avail ourselves of your outstanding ability," said Lawson, "and your expert advice on the country's industrial problems."
"It's men like you that we need in Washington," said Dr. Ferris. "There's no reason why you should have remained an outsider for so long, when your voice is needed at the top level of national leadership."
The sickening thing about it, thought Reardon, was that the speeches were only half lies. The other half, in their tone of hysterical urgency, was the unstated wish to have it somehow be true.
"What did you want?" he asked.
"Why, to listen to you, Mr. Reardon," said Wesley Mooch, the jerk of his features imitating a frightened smile.
The smile was faked. The fear was real.
We want the benefit of your opinion on the nation's industrial crisis."
"I have nothing to say." "But, Mr. Reardon," said Dr. Ferris, "all we want is a chance to cooperate with you. I've told you once publicly that I don't cooperate at the point of a gun."
"Can't we bury the hatchet at a time like this?" said Lawson beseechingly.
"The gun? Go ahead."
It's
you who are holding it. Bury it if you think you can."
That was just a figure of speech," Lawson explained, blinking. "I was speaking metaphorically."
"I wasn't." "Can't we all stand together for the sake of the country in this hour of emergency?" said Dr. Ferris. "Can't we disregard our differences of opinion? We're willing to meet you halfway. If there's any aspect of our policy which you oppose, just tell us and we'll issue a directive to—"
"Cut it, boys. I didn't come here to help you pretend that I'm not in the position I'm in, and that any halfway is possible between us. Now come to the point. You've prepared some new gimmick to spring on the steel industry. What is it?" "As a matter of fact," said Mooch, "we do have a vital question to discuss in regard to the steel industry, but your language, Mr. Reardon—"
"We don't want to spring anything on you," said Holloway. "We asked you here to discuss it with you."
"I came here to take orders. Give them."
"But, Mr. Reardon, we don't want to look at it that way. We don't want to give you orders. We want your voluntary consent."
Reardon smiled.
"I know it."
"You do?"
Holloway started eagerly, but something about Reardon's smile made him slide into uncertainty.
"Well, then—"
"And you, brother," said Reardon, "know that that is the flaw in your game, the fatal flaw that will blast it sky high. Now, do you tell me what clout on my head you're working so hard not to let me notice? Or do I go home?"
"Oh, no, Mr. Reardon," cried Lawson with a sudden dart of his eyes to his wristwatch. "You can't go now. That is, I mean, you wouldn't want to go without hearing what we have to say."
"Then let me hear it."
He saw them glancing at one another. Wesley Mooch seemed afraid to address him. Mooch's face assumed an expression of petulant stubbornness, like a signal of command pushing the others forward. Whatever their qualifications to dispose of the fate of the steel industry, they had been brought here to act as Mooch's conversational bodyguards. Reardon wondered about the reason for the presence of James Taggart. Taggart sat in gloomy silence, sullenly sipping a drink, never glancing in his direction.
"We have worked out a plan," said Dr. Ferris too cheerfully, "which will solve the problems of the steel industry, and which will meet with your full approval as a measure providing for the general welfare while protecting your interests and ensuring your safety in a—" "Don't try to tell me what I'm going to think. Give me the facts." "It is a plan which is fair, sound, equitable, and—" "Don't tell me your evaluation. Give me the facts." "It is a plan which—"
Dr. Ferris stopped. He had lost the habit of naming facts.
Under this plan, said Wesley Mooch, we will grant the industry a 5% increase in the price of steel.
He paused triumphantly. Reardon said nothing.
Of course, some minor adjustments will be necessary, said Holloway airily, leaping into the silence as onto a vacant tennis court. A certain increase in prices will have to be granted to the producers of iron ore. Oh, 3% at most, in view of the added hardships which some of them, Mr. Larkin of Minnesota, for instance, will now encounter, inasmuch as they'll have to ship their ore by the costly means of trucks, since Mr. James Taggart has had to sacrifice his Minnesota branch line to the public welfare. And, of course, an increase in freight rates will have to be granted to the country's railroads. Let's say 7%, roughly speaking, in view of the absolutely essential need for...
Holloway stopped, like a player emerging from a whirlwind activity, to notice suddenly that no opponent was answering his shots.
But there will be no increase in wages, said Dr. Ferris hastily. An essential point of the plan is that we will grant no increase in wages to the steel workers in spite of their insistent demands. We do wish to be fair to you, Mr. Reardon, and to protect your interests, even at the risk of popular resentment and indignation.
Of course, if we expect labor to make a sacrifice, said Lawson, we must show them that management, too, is making certain sacrifices for the sake of the country. The mood of labor in the steel industry is extremely tense at present, Mr. Reardon. It is dangerously explosive, and in order to protect you from...
He stopped. Yes, said Reardon. From?
From possible violence, certain measures are necessary, which... Look, Jim, he turned suddenly to James Taggart. Why don't you explain it to Mr. Reardon as a fellow industrialist? Well, somebody's got to support the railroads, said Taggart, sullenly, not looking at him. The country needs railroads, and somebody's got to help us carry the load. And if we don't get an increase in freight rates...
No, 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 snapped Wesley Mooch. Tell Mr. Reardon about the working of the railroad unification plan.
Well, the plan is a full success, said Taggart lethargically, except for the not fully controllable element of time. It is only a question of time before our unified teamwork puts every railroad in the country back on its feet. The plan, I'm in a position to assure you, would work as successfully for any other industry.
No doubt about that, said Reardon, and turned to Mooch. Why do you ask the stooge to waste my time? What does the railroad unification plan to do with me?
But Mr. Reardon, cried Mooch with desperate cheerfulness, that's the pattern we're to follow. That's what we called you here to discuss.
What?
The steel unification plan.
There was an instant of silence, as of breaths drawn after a plunge. Reardon sat looking at them with a glance that seemed to be a glance of interest.
In view of the critical plight of the steel industry, said Mooch with a sudden rush, as if not to give himself time to know what made him uneasy about the nature of Reardon's glance, and since steel is the most vitally, crucially basic commodity, the foundation of our entire industrial structure, drastic measures must be taken to preserve the country's steelmaking facilities, equipment, and plant.
The tone and impetus of public speaking carried him that far, and no farther.
With this objective in view, our plan is really very simple, said Tinky Holloway, striving to prove it by the gaily bouncing simplicity of his voice. We'll lift all restrictions from the production of steel, and every company will produce all it can according to its ability. But to avoid the waste and danger of dog-eat-dog competition, all the companies will deposit their gross earnings into a common pool, to be known as the Steel Unification Pool, in charge of a special board. At the end of the year, the board will distribute these earnings by totaling the nation's steel output and dividing it by the number of open-hearth furnaces in existence, thus arriving at an average which will be fair to all. And every company will be paid according to its need. The preservation of its furnaces being its basic need, every company will be paid according to the number of furnaces it owns.
He stopped, waited, then added, That's it, Mr. Reardon. And getting no answer, said,
Oh, there's a lot of wrinkles to be ironed out, but that's it.
Whatever reaction they had expected, it was not the one they saw. Reardon leaned back in his chair, his eyes attentive, but fixed on space, as if looking at a not-too-distant distance. Then he asked, with an odd note of quietly impersonal amusement,
Will you tell me just one thing, boys? What is it you're counting on?